Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FN, broadcasting from the Sanctuary on Independent Media in Troy, New York, and I'm Mark Dunlight.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski, and today we will be discussing the issue of divesting the state's pension fund from fossil fuels with Senator Liz Krueger.
Then we'll have our regular peace segment with Mary Finneran of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace.
Afterwards, we'll have the second part of an interview with Devin Reinbeck, a local hypnotist, as part of our spirituality series.
And later on, we will have or hear from WOOC correspondent Masha Miller speak with Dr. David Petaniak, an expert in disability service and wellness. Let's start the show off with some headlines. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, public advocate Tish James, and city controller Scott Stringer announced on Wednesday that the two biggest New York City pension funds will divest from fossil fuels. The city also said it will sue the five largest fossil fuel companies for the damages caused by climate change. New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, however, continues to speak out against divestment of the state pension funds. We will have more on divestment later in the show.
As the New York State Legislature takes up a bill to eliminate cash bail for many crimes, the two biggest district attorney offices in New York City have already taken steps in that direction, ordering prosecutors not to request bail in most misdemeanor cases. They will not request bail for defendants accused of nonviolent misdemeanors like shoplifting, marijuana possession, and trespassing. They still may request bail in violent cases with vulnerable victims, such as domestic assaults, sex crimes, and child abuse.
The Time Union reports that the village of Hoosick Falls voted Tuesday night to sue Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics and Honeywell International for damages, blaming them for causing the contamination of the chemical linked to various diseases, including several cancers. The second lawsuit will challenge the more than $582,000 that the law firm of Fitzgerald Morris Baker Firth and his public relations firm, Bayhan Communications, want to charge the village for work done on a failed class action lawsuit against the companies last winter.
A federal judge on Tuesday temporarily blocked the Trump administration from ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program while their lawsuits play out in court. The judge ruled that the plaintiffs clearly demonstrated that the young immigrants, quote, were likely to suffer serious irreparable harm, unquote, without court action. The judge also said the lawyers have a strong chance of succeeding at trial. DACA has protected about 800,000 people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children or came with families who overstayed visas. The program includes hundreds of thousands of college-age students.
At least 15 people have died as a result of the mudslides in California, triggered when heavy rains hit hills that were recently devastated by wildfires. The death toll is expected to climb as some of the areas hardest hit by the recent fires remain inaccessible. At least 25 other people were injured. Hundreds of people remain trapped in their homes as mudslides block canyon roads, with waist-high mud pushing some homes off their foundations. This is just the latest example of extreme weather problems caused by climate change.
The Vermont Senate has passed legislation legalizing the possession of small amounts of marijuana. The law, which the governor says he will sign, will allow individuals to possess up to an ounce of marijuana and grow two mature plants. Vermont will become the first state to legalize marijuana through the legislative process. The eight states which have also legalized it have done so by citizen referendum.
City of Albany officials are standing behind the city's status as a sanctuary city for immigrants, even as the Trump administration threatens it with a loss of federal funds. City officials point out that the federal code governing communications between government agencies and the Immigration and Naturalization Service doesn't, in quotes, impose an affirmative obligation on the part of law enforcement to collect information regarding an individual's immigration or citizen status, end of quote. And so city police are within their rights to ask about the immigration status only when necessary for investigating criminal activity.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, raided 7-Eleven convenience stores at 98 locations across the country on Wednesday. Agents interviewed employees, delivered audit notifications, and made 21 arrests in what has been described as the largest coordinated ICE action since Trump took office. ICE officials say that they were trying to send a message that employers who don't submit to federal immigration policy will not be tolerated. 7-Eleven deferred responsibility for hiring practices to individual franchise owners.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. In our open and lead segment, we speak with New York State Senator Liz Krueger, and we're going to take a few minutes here, about divesting the state's pension funds from fossil fuels. As we pointed out earlier today, it was a very historic announcement in New York City that the city will be divesting its pension funds from fossil fuels, as well as suing the five fossil fuel companies for the damage they have caused by climate change. About 10 days ago, Governor Cuomo had come out and called for the state to divest its pension funds from fossil fuels. However, the governor does not have any role in the pension fund that's at the state level, controlled by the state controller, Tom DiNapoli, who's been very opposed to divestment. So we're going to talk with Senator Liz Krueger, who is the lead sponsor for state legislation to divest the pension funds from fossil fuels. So this is Mark Dunley, and I'm talking with Senator Liz Krueger, who has been the longtime sponsor of legislation to get the state pension funds to divest from fossil fuels. Recently, Governor Cuomo came out and said he supported the concept of divestment. And Senator Krueger, how does the governor's announcement about his support to divestment actually change the issue?
Well, I think it brings even more attention to this issue that some people know a lot about and some people know nothing about. So just to start again, I have a bill that would require Tom DiNapoli, the state controller, to divest from our pension funds any money invested in the 200 largest fossil fuel companies in the world. It's about $5 billion of our $200 billion pension fund. My legislation would give him 5 years to divest and gives him an out clause if any individual divestment of specific stock would cause a real risk to the pension dollars of the people of New York State who depend on his good investment in pensions. But $5 billion on $200 billion, not that much, but a significant statement by government that we should, one, not be investing in the most dangerous products that exist, doing damage to the future of our climate and the stability of the earth. Two, freeze up money to then be available to invest in sustainable, far less dangerous types of industries that should be our future in energy, green energy, offshore wind, solar, other kinds of models that will help ensure both a good return on investment and the right answers for the economy and the environment. Three, sending a clear message to all investors. Why are you putting your money in antiquated models that only cause damage to our economy and our earth? We know that in order to address the ever-shrinking timelines on climate change, we basically have to stop pulling fossil fuels out of the earth now. should have done it 5 years ago. But we want to send the message that investors should not be putting their money into companies whose job it is to pull fossil fuels out of the earth, doing harm. We're not saying every company that might use fossil fuels for something should be divested from. That's a future world where no one needs to use fossil fuels. We're talking about companies who are not going to change their behavior because their bottom line is pulling fossil fuels out of the earth, and that's what we need to stop doing. So we think it's a win-win as an investment strategy to get out of fossil fuels, as environmental policy to get out of fossil fuels, to invest these monies in sustainable green energy models, and that government, because it is looked at by so many others in society for investment advice, that it sends a message to investors across the board, it's way past time to stop investing in fossil fuels.
Now, I think as you mentioned, State Controller Tom DiNapoli has the right as a sole trustee to divest. He's not done that yet. Governor Cuomo, who doesn't really have direct oversight over the pension funds, has come out. So does that, other than some publicity, does that change the dynamics in the state legislature that they might be more willing to move this, or does that move Tom DiNapoli?
Well, Tom DiNapoli, I believe, has come out and said that he continues to take the position he takes. And by the way, I think overall Tom DiNapoli is doing an extraordinary job as the controller, an extraordinary job protecting our pension funds, and some very good policy when it comes to the environment. We don't agree on the legislature superseding him with a divestment bill telling him what he has to do. As I will say over and over again to Tom DiNapoli, if he wants to do it voluntarily and beat the legislature or the governor to the punch, that's just fine with me. The governor coming out in support of divestment is another important voice out there saying it's smart public policy for government not to be invested in fossil fuels. There are plenty of governments all over the world at this point who are second-guessing themselves and their past policies and divesting or changing their policies to move out of fossil fuels. We see sovereign nation funds pulling their money out. We see the World Bank recently announcing it's not going to be continuing to invest in fossil fuels. Several other of the international investment entities created by government to handle pensions and other large sums of government money are divesting. Private businesses, universities, municipalities. There is a growth in the movement of recognition that divestment is in no way a silver bullet solving our problems, but is a clear message that as an investment strategy, fossil fuels are a dying effort.
Well, in terms of investment, actually, I do understand that the not only the city of Ithaca, but the town of Cooperstown has divested. Happens to be that a former CEO or vice president of Exxon is now a town trustee in Cooperstown, and he led the fight. You have another bill in. I was actually kind of surprised to hear that New York State actually gives various forms of tax breaks and tax credits, about $1.5 billion to the fossil fuel industry. How do we continue to do that at a time when allegedly the state is, you know, on record as saying we need to move away from fossil fuels?
Well, exactly your point. So to help clarify, the New York State tax code is filled with things we get taxed for. It's also filled with exemptions, often called tax expenditures, where you don't pay taxes for certain activities. And the theory is if you want to incentivize or encourage certain kinds of economic activity, you decrease or zero out taxes on those activities. So I was shocked to see when I looked through the tax expenditure budget of the state of New York that in the 21st century, we had about $1.5 billion in tax exemptions and expenditures that we give out every year to the petroleum industry. We're not an oil state. We're not Texas. Why would we be giving taxpayer dollars to support the petroleum and fossil fuels industry? We certainly don't want to incentivize people to use fossil fuels. So why would we be giving them tax reductions for using them? So I believe, and my bill would do this, is to evaluate and zero out every tax expenditure for the petroleum industry, unless upon of study and evaluation, the state actually said there's an overriding public good in continuing this. And the truth is, the state of New York has billions and billions and billions of dollars that we give out as tax expenditures and exemptions every year without looking at them, just because they've been on the books forever. So I also have another bill that would require a sunset on all tax exemptions and expenditures, where they only got continued if upon evaluation and vote it was determined that they were justified and would continue. So that's a larger effort across the board on tax expenditures, but to start with petroleum and fossil fuel tax exemptions seems to me to be way past time.
Now, one issue that's gotten a little bit more traction in the last year has been the issue of carbon price and a carbon tax, and probably because the governor made what many of us felt was an ill-advised bailout of a couple of upstate nuclear power plants to about $7.6 billion. But he did that based on the social cost of carbon, and now the other electric producers are saying, well, great idea, Governor, where's our subsidy? And so now the Public Service Commission is looking at that. The governor has also looked into the possibility of doing some type of regional approach to some type of carbon tax or carbon fee on transportation. And I know you've had a bill in, I believe, for a couple of years trying to do at least a feasibility study of carbon pricing. What's your sense of what needs to happen to make this thing move this year?
Well, I think we're also seeing growth in discussions about the carbon tax and the carbon footprint. So you're seeing regional proposals in different places around the country, and hopefully a regional proposal that starts to move forward here in the Northeast. There's group efforts to come up with a carbon tax, I believe, of about $35 a ton. The reason people talk about needing to do this on a regional basis is to avoid the hypothetical flight of business across state lines to avoid this kind of carbon tax. But if you're doing it for entire regions, you really help fight against that. So I think there's also excellent opportunity at least to get serious discussion of that going, because it's the combination of the need to address a growing crisis, the need for revenue by this state as well as other states, and the recognition that with the federal government almost going in full speed reverse of the things we need to do, the states have to up the ante and take care of themselves and protect their people, because the cavalry is not on its way from Washington, D.C.
To throw you a little bit of a curveball, I know that you had done a lot of work as an anti-hunger advocate for many years, both in the food bank and advocacy community, and also the state legislature. I was just sort of curious what your reaction was to the idea about the governor that it's time to spend $1 million to help create some food pantries on college campuses.
I was glad to hear the governor talk about the issues of hunger for young people, and as I heard it in his written speech, not necessarily in the verbal speech, we're talking about kindergarten through college. So the governor refocusing some attention on the crisis of hunger for low-income young people, whether they're 2 years old or 21 years old, is a good sign. The proposal to put government money into emergency food pantries, as you and I both know from our histories, you turn to emergency food when all your government programs have failed. When you have the right kind of government programs and the right kind of economy, people who are able to work for the wages they need to be able to take care of themselves and their family, food and rent, and other basic needs. When that model has failed you, you end up with people who live in crisis and don't have enough money to meet their food needs. I would have loved to see announcement about expansion of SNAP eligibility and support, for college students, of course, under the federal law, only probably about half of low-income college students could be eligible for SNAP. But really, wouldn't that be a huge victory if every person in New York State, whether it was a child, a young person going to school, a senior citizen, a low-wage working person, if every person who was eligible for SNAP received SNAP, that would bring billions more into the state economy, which would have significantly greater impact than a few million dollars for emergency food. But I'll never knock somebody opening a food pantry or a soup kitchen to respond to immediate need when they're seeing it. My understanding is, at least in New York City, our public universities mostly already have emergency food pantries.
And we've been talking with Senator Liz Krueger, and this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC. So as I mentioned earlier, the mayor and the public advocate and the New York City Comptroller did do what many are viewing as an historic announcement today, saying that New York City is going to divest from fossil fuels. And it's either the second or third largest public pension plan in the country, close to about $160 billion. And we had Senator Krueger on as she was the lead sponsor of the legislation at the state level to divest. And we snuck in a few questions about carbon pricing and hunger.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. In our next segment, we speak with Mary Finneran as part of an ongoing coverage on the local peace movement. Mary is with Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, an organization formed in January 2003 that now has more than 700 members, and it is growing. BNP is comprised of a wide spectrum of adults and youth working for a peaceful diplomatic solution to the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere in the world. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Before he left office, President Dwight Eisenhower warned the American people to be careful about the growing power of the military-industrial complex. Can you explain what he was warning the American people about, and how powerful it has become?
Military-industrial complex is exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about actually the military-industrial power complex. It rules pretty much everything. I mean, in everything corporate, all kinds of, but especially the oil, gas, energy segment is the biggest part of the military-industrial complex, the biggest part of the industrial complex. And it's interesting that it's come as far as it has, and they really rule everything. The energy corporations have, as their servants, the military, the U.S. military. They're the guard dogs for the energy corporations.
So how much of the military action here in the United States is guided by our desire to take control of the natural resources of other countries, such as Russia or in the Middle East?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's just about everything. I mean, you can go as far as the Congo. Any actions with the U.S. in the Congo is due to the cobalt for our cell phones. Afghanistan has not only the routes for oil pipelines, but it has huge amounts of very valuable minerals that for extraction. Iraq, the war in Iraq was basically for oil. That is why the whole thing was with weapons of mass destruction and everything else was so that we could have, we didn't like the fact that Iraq had control of their, Iraq had control of their oil. We wanted to have that control. We wanted to have that oil. And when I say we, I'm talking about the United States industrial complex.
One of the other issues you're concerned with is about nuclear weapons and our efforts to expand the nuclear energy program. Can you explain that connection?
Well, if you think about when Iran wanted to get a power plant, a nuclear power plant, and the United States started to set sanctions against them and was, you know, sending the EIA to...
I'm sorry, the EIA?
Is it the EIA? Who is it? The Energy... Correct me, please. I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but the nuclear energy agency to go and look and control what they were doing with nuclear power. And we didn't want them to have the nuclear power plant, not because of that we didn't want them to have nuclear power, but because our fear was that they would be building up vast amounts of weapons-grade plutonium. And so they were afraid that they would come up with a nuclear weapon. And other places in the Middle East were concerned about that. Israel was concerned about them being able to build up a nuclear stockpile. And kind of in a strange way, I remember at the time thinking, well, we have a lot of nuclear power plants here. And what is, why when they're going down financially, they're not able to be economically feasible. They don't do that good a job with providing electricity. But we still seem to have this need to have these power plants. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that these power plants can be creating weapons-grade plutonium. And especially when you consider that Obama started to really push to have to upgrade the nuclear power, nuclear weapons that we have. So it's it might be conjecture on my part, but I don't think it's out of the range of what they were considering regarding Iran.
So could you maybe go into a little bit more details and describe about, you know, when you say that the Obama administration was upgrading the nuclear weapons, you know, what exactly did that mean?
It meant that they wanted to they were doing research on how to make nuclear weapons better, and also to create more, to have more powerful ones. Which is ludicrous considering that we could destroy the planet like 4,000 times with what we have. So why they wanted to do this? Why they want to do this now? Why I think that's a lot of what's going on with the Korean thing is our fear of the nuclear from them is we can destroy the planet many, many times.
How do you feel about Trump bringing in Rex Tillerson, former executive CEO of Exxon, as Secretary of State?
Well, that just is kind of like the coup de grace for the a fascist kind of state here. Rex Tillerson was the head of one of the biggest oil and gas industry. A couple of years ago, they were the largest corporation. They've actually lost some. It's being the number one profit monger, can I say? I think it's pretty scary. Rex Tillerson is such a has basically fracked this country. ExxonMobil. He was the head of ExxonMobil. He did step down before he became Secretary of State. But as Secretary of State, with all of his connections to it's kind of like Cheney's connections, that they could go to different countries and kind of, strong-arm them into letting us have their oil, or manipulating things and using the military, the backing of the military, to kind of scare these other countries into giving us what we, what they want.
So maybe could you go over in a little detail about it? So how does, Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace actually approach these issues? And, my sort of conception of Bethlehem is sort of a, suburban, pretty well-to-do community. How is Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace received by local residents?
I think they've become very well received. People look for them on their vigil every Monday evening at 5. They have programs at the library, which draw in a good number of people, several dozens. And I think, you know, they go to the town board meetings. They're really very active. They have been trying to, and I think the high school has responded to them, too. They've had kids come through and work with them on this. Trudy Quaife is amazing with her newsletters every week. They promote different activities. A lot of activities here at the sanctuary they've promoted. I'm very proud to be a part of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace.
Well, thank you, Mary. That was Mary Finneran of the Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace.
Well, no, I did want to jump in with an additional question. Well, you know, one of the things we see at the national level is that you get the military, you know, providing their surplus equipment to the local police and also doing training. I've never seen this in Ferguson. I said, what's those tanks doing out there in Ferguson? So what is this whole thing behind the militarization of the local police department?
Well, I think this is conjecture on my part. But I do think it is related to the fact that we are basically becoming a resource colony. We are exporting, we are now exporting liquid natural gas. We're exporting oil. And so they have to be sure that they're protecting us. They're also protecting people who don't want to go into the military, people who are, you know, who feel like they have to. But that, just to stop all of the, anybody protesting. They want to declare, there was a statute in New York City, I think it was, that they wanted to make environmental activists give them terrorist status. So in order to be able to do that and have the numbers that we have, they have to have their police be well protected with their Kevlar and their armament.
So one of the people we've had previously on here for Bethlehem's Neighbors for Peace has been Joe Lombardo, who's also with... UNAC.
United National Anti-War Coalition.
And so he says, make sure you ask Mary about what's going on in Yemen and the whole situation with the United States support in Saudi Arabia, who's, you know, very much favoring one side and what's increasing, I don't know if it's a civil war, but a lot of people dying over there.
I am not that well versed in it. But it's what it is. It's again using our friends, the people who have more power, the people who are giving us whatever we want, will step in and help them however they want to be helped too. And Yemen is just a victim of that kind of mindset.
Well, another thing that's of course taking place is right now, you know, after we went through the tremendous tax cuts that the Republicans enacted at the federal level that created a $1.5 trillion additional deficit. That means, of course, that we're going to have to now be serious about the budget deficit and slash spending in the federal budget, or we're going to close down the government. And about 53% of the discretionary federal budget is for the military. So does that mean that Trump and the Republicans are going to be trying to slash that military budget to a lower number?
I doubt that very, very much. I think it's more likely they're going to be cutting the education. They're going to be cutting the EPA. There's websites that do comparison charts on how much. The fact that the military has over 50% of the budget is just a sign of how important the corporations want to have the military in there and how much money they want to give them. Plus all the corporations that are supplying them with their equipment and their weapons.
Hmm. Now, I didn't mean to give you the bum rush a few minutes ago.
Oh, that's not quite
but now right. I guess now it's time to say that was Mary Finneran, and she's with the Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was good to be here.
Okay. Thank you. As I said, that was Mary Finneran from the Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace. You can find out more about the group by going online to Bethlehem for Peace. Now that's F-O-R peace.org. Bethlehem 4, F-O-R peace.org. And thanks for joining us. I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn about how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
We now turn to a continuation of last week's spirituality segment, where WOOC correspondent Des Moines George sat down with Devin Reinbach, a hypnotist new to the Troy area, to discuss what is reality?
To get to a real question of hypnosis, what is reality? You know, when you watch especially old movies from the 50s and you see hypnosis and it's like driven as, you know, this kind of, you sit in a room, question reality for about 30 minutes, and then after those 30 minutes you accept a new reality and you walk out and into that new reality that you created for those 30 minutes, and that new reality is now your reality forevermore. And it's really a question of reality. So how do you feel hypnosis in reality as a concept even kind of work together?
So I've thought about this a lot for many years, and the rabbit hole goes very deep.
It does.
Deeper, probably it's infinitely deep. Without getting too philosophical, my conception of reality today is two-sided. Well, first, we live in a dualistic reality. We've got left and right, black and white, up and down, yin and yang. We've also got information and experience. So information, I guess you can make the analogy between mathematical code behind a program, and the experience is, you know, actually experiencing the world with our five senses. You know, at least five senses. Some say we may have more. And I'm sure you've heard that all is belief, right? All is belief. Many people have said that. And in a way, that's totally true. To the extent that, you know, there may not be an objective reality at all. Like, the ultimate truth may be that there is no ultimate truth, right?
Right.
The ultimate truth is really every story that has ever been told, ever will be told, and is being told right now. The only way to know everything is to know everyone's experience, because that we all collectively make up this reality together. So, as far as individual realities go, like my own personal reality, I would say there's the outer world and the inner world. The outer world is, you know, I mean, I'm talking to you, and I can look around this room and see all the things on the walls, and, you know, the inner world is my internal experience, the things that are going on in my mind right now, all these thoughts and beliefs and emotions. And a lot of the time, our beliefs about ourselves and the world around us are not really conscious. We don't have them on our minds. Like, when we say something is on our mind, like, oh, I was thinking about you, that's the conscious mind. The unconscious mind deals with basically everything else. It's the rest of the iceberg, right? If the conscious mind is the tip, it's dreams, it's emotions, it's beliefs. A lot of them are unconscious, and a lot of them developed when we were much younger. So we've got this whole slew of beliefs as programming that are, you know, reinforced every day, and those beliefs about ourselves and the world around us can shape our reality. So, you know, let's say we're sitting at a table at a restaurant, right? We look over and we see a family, a couple and a kid. And one of the parents stands up and he's talking really loudly and he's waving his arms and whatever. So, and you mentioned you're Buddhist, right? So you'll totally get this. So now we wonder what's going on, because it's so loud we can't really hear anything. And well, from our perspective, understanding Buddhism, we would say, well, there's two parents and a kid, and one of the parents just got up and waved his arm around. That's basically it. Someone else might say, oh, you know, he's really pissed off. He's very angry right now. Another person might say, oh, he's probably just, like, saying, wow, did you see them? Did you see the... Our favorite team scored. He's pointing at the TV back there, you know? We all experience reality differently based on our inner world. So a lot of the time, when people try to make changes in their personal reality, like they want to quit smoking, or they want to lose weight, or they want to reduce stress, they may have tried everything. You know, I've tried everything. Nothing works. It could very well be that it's a belief or a thought about yourself that's holding you back. Like, oh, I could never do it. Or, I don't really deserve a better life. It could be anything. What hypnosis does is allows you to build a better rapport with your own unconscious mind. So you can be your own therapist and talk with yourself and say, all right, let me enter trance and figure out what is going on. And you'd be surprised how quickly it starts talking back. It right away. Oh, I've been waiting for you to open the door. All right, now here's all this stuff. And it's just, it's really powerful.
Yeah, when you think of reality as dualism, you kind of have to accept that there is a whole other side that exists that you might not be taking into play. So, yeah, that it is just all there within your reality, and it's just your consciousness. What you're conscious of in a moment might change, which would, say, evolve your reality. But the reality has always consist of all those things. Mm-hmm. So nothing's new under the sun. And so if somebody wanted to get in contact with you to either talk about your services or just maybe hear more from you on these topics, how would they get in contact with you?
So they can go to my website, which is dr-hypnosis.com. All my contact info is there. I'm also on Facebook if you look for d.r.hypnosis. All the info is on the website. And I look really forward to speaking with you soon.
Thanks, Devin.
So, snap out of it. That was Des Moines, George with Devin Reinbach, a hypnotist new to the Troy area. You can get in contact with Devin by visiting his website at dr for doctor hyphen hypnosis hypnosis .com.
In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Masha Miller spoke with Dr. David Petoniak, an expert on disability services, about his life and work.
Hi, David.
Hi, Masha.
I'm Masha Miller interviewing David Petoniak.
That's good.
So tell us about your background.
Well, I grew up in Montpelier, Vermont, and I would leave Vermont and go to school in Virginia and fall in love with my wife, Cindy, and we have two boys, Joe and Sam, and we live in Blacksburg, Virginia now.
Thank you. How old are your sons?
My son Joe is 33, and my son Sam is 31. They're all grown up now.
What kind of doctor are you?
I have my PhD in developmental disabilities from Virginia Commonwealth University.
What made you to go into this career and job and workforce?
Well, years ago, I was working at a camp in Vermont for children who had disabilities, and I really liked the work. I really liked the kids a lot, and that made me think, maybe this is something I might want to do with the rest of my life for a job, and that's really what happened. It just went from one thing to the next.
Who are your mentors, and who are the people you looked up to?
Well, that's such a great question. And I had lots of mentors. My wife, Cindy, is the person who's taught me the most about people and about being in the world in a compassionate way, in a quiet way. She's just an amazing, amazing woman. So there's nobody that holds a candle to her. One of my mentors is a man named Roland, who has autism, who taught me many, many things about many, many things. And I also had a boss at the University of Vermont named Susan Hazazi. And Susan, she kind of taught me the ropes and taught me how to think about a lot of the things I think about today. I also had a mentor named Herb Lovett, who many people know. Herb has passed away, but he was a very, very good teacher and a really thoughtful man. So he was helpful. Another person who's been a great mentor of mine is named Al Vecchione, Dr. Al Vecchione from Vermont. And he's a person who's taught me a lot about anxiety in the body, something that I know you wanted to talk about during the interview.
Do you have any advice or strategies on stress or anxiety?
Well, that's such a great question. As you know, I'm really interested in the role anxiety plays in our lives. One way to think about this is that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are people who are very mellow and relaxed, and then there are people who are very anxious. And if I had to be in one of those camps, it would be in the anxious camp. I tend to have nervous energy in my body. Sometimes I have worrisome thoughts that are hard for me to stop. But over time, I've learned some strategies. One strategy that's really helpful to me and my anxiety is just to move aerobically, to exercise. And for me, that's just taking long walks. I just always feel so much better after a long walk. And if I'm careful and get good sleep and eat good food, I do just fine. But I tend to be anxious in my body a good part of the time. Sometimes when we're all just anxious, but then there are times when we get so anxious we can't think clearly about things, and we kind of melt down. And
oh yes,
you know that feeling. The work is just to figure out what are those things that we can do that help us from stopping ourselves before we get to that point where we're just melting down. And that's why I so much appreciate your question.
What do you do in crisis? How can you help people who are in crisis? Like they just want to attack. That's number one. And number two is how do you make sure they don't get to that place? Answer those two questions.
Yeah, those are great questions. The first thing I've tried to learn, and I learned this from my friend Al Vecchione, who I told you about mm-hmm. just a bit ago, is I always try to hold on to my first reaction. Because usually when someone is attacking me or attacking others...
Physically and emotionally.
Yeah. My tendency is to want to jump in and try to help too mm-hmm. much. And sometimes it's better if I just stay quiet and peaceful and try to help the person calm down. Then I'll ask the person, you know, what's up? What can I do to help? And let them be in charge of deciding what works for them. Sometimes this takes a while for people to hear it because they're so upset, but waiting for them to calm down and then being in service to them helps a lot, because the work is for them to come back into their body and to go into the part of the brain that can think about things. But when they're really, really upset, they've left their body. They're not in the brain that can think about things very clearly. So anything I can do to be soothing and nurturing and helpful to a person is what I first try to do.
What do you think about when people have to go to like bad places, like places where they're like captured because they hurt people or jail or any of that stuff because of attacking someone?
You mean that they attack someone and so they end up in a place like jail?
Yeah, jail or one of those places like I did.
Yeah. You know, I feel bad for people because I know most people that I ever meet don't mean to be hurtful to others. They're just in bodies that are really, really anxious. And often places like jails aren't very helpful at...
And all the treatment centers, can you go over, please?
Well, a lot of them
can you go down the road? So what is a mental institution?
Well, a mental institution is usually a place where people who have mental health issues end up going because there aren't the proper supports for them in the community. And we need them less and less because more and more we're building good supports for people in community settings when they need them.
What about the place where they have to be locked up? What's that called?
Well, there are places like jail. Is that what you mean? Or
no, you locked
mean,
up.
So you mean like a mental health hospital?
Yeah. What's a mental health hospital?
Well, that's like a institution.
What is an institution?
Well, an institution is all that means is it's a place that people go sometimes and they have to be confined or under lock and key.
What is a mental institution?
That's a place sometimes where people, when they are hurtful to themselves or hurtful to other people, they end up. But frankly, sometimes people that don't really have very serious issues going on end up there because no one knows how to find support for them in the community, which is what we all have to get better at doing.
And then what about one in the hospital ones? Well, the award. That's different, correct?
Well,
can you tell us the big difference between those?
Well, they can be different, but they're often the same. I'm not sure I know the difference. I always think of them as being the same.
It's not because you can leave.
Yeah, in both cases, people often just can't leave when they want to.
No, but in a hospital, you only can stay a month.
Oh, I see.
Can you talk about the difference between those two?
I see, yeah. Well, some places are very short-term.
No, between a hospital and the other thing.
I hear you. Some places
between a hospital and the other thing. So for how long do you have to be in a hospital? And then answer the second question.
You know, I know that I don't really know the exact answer to your question.
It's for a month, I believe, for Samaritan.
Yeah, you might be right. I think it varies from place to place, so it might be longer here or shorter here than it is in Virginia where I live, but they put a time limit on it because it's very expensive and they want people to get out into the community as quick as possible.
That's only in a hospital, correct?
You know what? I think you might be right, but I'm not exactly sure.
I thought you're the expert.
Well, not on these kinds of things. I'm not very much an expert on how funding works.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bad, isn't it? How can people stay away from this?
Well, what we need to do is build really good support in community places, in the places that they live. And we can do that. We know how to do that. It's just that too often we don't do it well.
What about their family?
Well, that's a really good question. It really impacts lots of people, the person himself or herself and their family.
Or they.
Yeah, exactly.
Or they.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that again, please?
Yeah, sometimes it impacts the individual, the person, and sometimes it affects their family as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Signing off. Thank you very much for having us. Thank you very much for letting me interview and you and having us on the air.
Masha, thank you so much for having me, and I'm really impressed at how well you handled this interview, being one of your first.
Thank you. WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
And that was Masha Miller interviewing Dr. David Pitaniak, an expert or consultant on disability services with the Rensselaer County ARC.
The so-called bomb trains parked on rail lines in downtown Albany and nearby residential neighborhoods are a constant local reminder of the fracking industry. The environmental impact of this industry extends far beyond urban areas into the pristine Adirondack wilderness, as our colleagues at North Country Public Radio have been reporting. The following, we'll hear from Brian Mann and Martha Foley with the story.
One of the biggest Adirondack stories of 2017 was the decision by Iowa Pacific Railroad and its subsidiary, the Saratoga North Creek Railroad, to store mothballed rail cars in the park. Dozens of cars have already arrived on a stretch of track in the town of Minerva near the Boreas River in the High Peaks Wilderness. Those cars are now being removed, but the company says it's already planning to bring hundreds more of these industrial freight and tanker cars into the Adirondacks. Just remind us first, why would Iowa Pacific want to store these cars here?
Yeah, so the rail freight industry nationwide, Martha, has a huge glut of these unused tanker and freight cars, thanks in large part to a slowdown in the oil and gas and also the coal industries. These companies have been reluctant to scrap the cars, so they need miles and miles of track to just store them. And Iowa Pacific, this struggling rail company that operates a tourist train in Warren, Saratoga County, is also a little bit of Essex County. They're trying to generate additional revenue by creating what amounts to a big industrial parking lot. Governor has called this a dumping ground.
Yeah, and it sits right near some of the wildest lands in the park, which is a big concern. But we did just hear that a lot of these cars are being removed.
Yeah, that's right. A company called Union Tank Car, based in Chicago, bowed to pressure from Governor Cuomo and agreed that all of its cars would be hauled out of the park and, in fact, taken out of the state of New York. That was a big victory for Governor Cuomo and also the green groups that have raised the loudest alarm over Iowa Pacific's storage plan. But Iowa Pacific says, you know, they're not done.
In fact, there are hundreds more cars coming, already scheduled to arrive. Governor Cuomo, not surprisingly, has said he's going to try to stop this. But what are his options?
Well, the governor has already urged a federal agency to block this rail car storage plan. But Iowa Pacific has indicated that they think they can win this legal fight. The other answer appears to be the possibility of New York State simply buying out Iowa Pacific's rights to this line up to Tahoe. The company is mired in financial and legal difficulties all over North America, and they've signaled that they would let the state buy out their interests in the rail line that goes right up to the very border of the High Peaks. That would likely cost taxpayers several million dollars. I should say, Martha, that in an editorial, the Glens Falls Post-Star described this as a kidnap ransom scheme by Iowa Pacific. But the newspaper also concluded that the Cuomo administration should consider paying up in order to protect the park's public lands.
Okay, so we'll see where that goes. But I have a question here. What's the thinking about the future of this railroad line if New York State does, in fact, buy it? There's more questions here than just about mothballed tanker cars.
Right. That's right. And this does get a bit confusing, Martha, but there are really two chunks here. First of all, there's the stretch of the line that goes to North Creek, and that's owned by Warren County. And they very much would like that to remain a tourist line active with tourist trains. But that's not been very successful as a business. And so there's real questions about what the future of the tourist train is going to be. And then there's a separate stretch of the line that goes from North Creek up to Tahoe through that wild country into Essex County. And there is new thinking now about what that might be, perhaps some kind of rail trail, multi-use kind of access, something maybe for snowmobilers or skiers, bicycle riders. So as with other parts of the park, there are big questions being raised about how these rail corridors should be used, what purposes they might serve for tourism and other things. And certainly this controversy has reopened that big question.
And so I should point out, actually, it appears that this train situation got resolved once it was figured out that actually Warren Buffett either owned the trains or owned the railroad lines. And once the Adirondack groups brought it to his attention, gave him some bad press, they were able to win that issue. But that was a report by correspondents Brian Mann and Martha Foley, and it comes courtesy of our friends at North Country Public Radio. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I want to thank Jonah Moberg and Sarone Cunningham for their wonderful job trying to help engineer around our two correspondent announcers here. But I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Now remember to listen again tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at the Sanctuary, 7:07 p.m., held right here in the back room. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.